I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee and Jobs and Workforce Development Policy Committee, calling this meeting to order. And welcome to everyone who's here in person, and welcome to those joining us online, who include both a number of our members and also members of the public. A reminder that this joint meeting is being held pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for virtual hearings of this type. And a lot of meeting materials are posted to our committee websites, I think maybe even both websites, and members of the public, you'll want to check those out for information. So I'll turn things to my co-chair, Chair Noor, to welcome us and get the roll call going and everything else.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you, everyone, for coming to District 60B, the beautiful district. This is my district, and I'm honored that you're all here this evening. And so I just wanted to let you know this is an important discussion. It's about early care. As a father of four young school-age kids, I understand the challenges, but I appreciate the work that people are doing. We've got more to learn and more to do and to discuss during this deliberation of this meeting today. I wanted to ask the committee legislative assistant, Abdihamid Badri, to call the roll call.
Chair Pinto?
Present.
Chair Noor?
Present.
Vice Chair Pryor?
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang?
Present.
Lead Franzen?
Present.
Lead Hamilton?
Present.
Baker? Baker? Bennett?
Present.
Golden?
Present.
Daniels?
Present.
Dabney?
Dabney, present.
Damon?
Present.
Frankie?
Frankie, present.
Greenman?
Greenman, present.
Haley?
Haley, present.
Juergens?
Juergens, present.
Hagel?
Present.
Patiza Witun?
Present.
Morrison?
Morrison, present.
Olson?
Present.
Wazlowick?
Present.
Wolgamott? Wolgamott?
Present.
Zhang?
Present.
Baker? Baker? Chairs, we have a quorum.
There's a quorum present. With that, I just wanted to get going. Chair Pinto, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So members, this is the third in a series of joint hearings between these committees that date back to early 2019. We had a joint hearing under then Chair Mahoney in March of 2019 in St. Cloud. We had a hearing in October of 2019 in Winona. And the crisis that we talked about at that time and those two hearings really has only gotten deeper in the time of COVID. And I want to emphasize, just as we listen to our testifiers today, we need to think about this from two perspectives. It tends to be that we think separately in our minds about the crisis in child care. We know how unaffordable it is for families and inaccessible for families, and the deep poverty wages that are paid to those who do this really critical work. And the impact that that has on not only families, but on employers and on communities. So there's a crisis in childcare. And then the worker shortage that our employers are experiencing, in part because of those childcare issues. That's on the one hand. We also need to recognize that we're aware of the opportunity gaps that are squeezing our state and will continue to, and that those gaps start in the earliest years, and that's an issue relating to early learning. And that just as we learned that K-12 education is also care for children in those ages, so too, child care is early learning, and early learning is child care. And so as we listen to our testifiers, just to keep in mind, these are really multiple crises that we have going. And on the flip side, multiple opportunities to get young kids off to a great start in life. And so with that opportunity, that sense of opportunity, I'd like to call up our first testifier. And we are so honored to have him with us and to be in this beautiful space. I'm sorry for those of you joining us virtually, and I hope that you can't be with us in person. And I hope that as the pandemic lifts, you'll be able to visit this just gorgeous facility, the Masonic Institute for the Developing Brain. So calling up Damian Fair, who's the Red Leaf Endowed Director for the Institute, to talk about the Institute and then also talk with us about the first 1,000 days and how important it is in these to make these early investments. So Director, please come on up, Dr. Fair, and please share your testimony with us. Thanks so much for being here.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you all for having me open this legislative session. It really means a lot for us here at MIB to have you guys here in this brand new facility, which encompasses world-leading basic and applied science research, cutting-edge clinical services in pediatrics and in mental health, and world-renowned community outreach and advocacy programs, all in this new space that is tailored towards families' well-being and optimal collaboration, not only with folks here at the what I call the university island, but also with our community members, educators, business leaders, and even policymakers. So now the mission at MIVB is to foster healthy brain development. And go to the next slide. Across the lifespan, advance preventative translational applied sciences and neurodevelopment, and translate research to clinical management, education, community services, and effective policy in a culturally sensitive context. So, how do we do it? Well, if you can go ahead to the next slide. What we're doing here is we're bringing together historically relatively siloed units that include the child and adolescent psychiatry, pediatrics, psychology, and the Institute of Child Development, the Institute of Community Integration, which does a lot of work with policy, community outreach, and disabilities, the Center for Magnetic Resonance Research, which does a lot of work, as some folks might know, with brain imaging, brain health, as long with several other folks who may not live in the building, including the neuroscience department, research computing and informatics, several community organizations, MHealth Fairview, all kind of coming together to make a more efficient pipeline for brain health in our youth. And so why do we do it? Well, we do it so that the focus of our basic science research can be efficiently aligned with the needs of the community and our educators and our policymakers and our business leaders. And B, so that when an important discovery is actually made, that we can hand the baton off to the people who can run with that information and get in the hands of the people who can use it to improve brain health in our communities. Now, currently, like right now, if I make a discovery in my own laboratory, it may take more than 17 years for that information to actually reach and touch the people and utilize the next generation treatments or applied in new, to improve our education. That's just way too long, and we're going to change that. Now, one of our major focuses, and the focus of this session is the first 1,000 days. You can go ahead to the next session. So why do we care about the first 1,000 days? Well, here's a diagram that you can see on the screen here that's depicting the making of the brain. It's the development of the brain across the lifespan, all the way from conception to, according to this graph, the end of life, which occurs at approximately the age of 60. Now, if you look at the making of the brain, there's lots of things that occur. There's what's called neurogenesis, which is the making, the building of neurons or the cells that communicate electrical signals across the brain for and how the brain functions. Those neurons are born in the center of the brain, called an area called the ventricular zone. They have to migrate over to their final resting place, which occurs from the second trimester all the way through almost the first year of life. There is a proliferation of the connections that link all these neurons together called synaptogenesis that occurs from approximately the end of the second trimester all the way through the first or so year of life. There's what's called programmed cell death, or cells start slowly kind of automatically essentially dying, that kind of continues on through the first 2 years, 2 years of life. Now, from there, you know, what happens is you start those, all those proliferation of the synapses start to prune away. In fact, the total number of all the cells that you're almost all the cells that you're ever going to have for your entire lifetime essentially are born and put into place in there by the time you're about a year old. Okay. And everything from there is mostly kind of pruning things away. So what does that mean? So if you go to the next slide. Well, this means that opposed to kind of popular opinion about brain development, it's much less like a building that you kind of build up into the final structure, but more like a sculpture where you have this big rock that you slowly start chiseling away that gets you to your final place. And I'm presenting that as an example of this nice sculpture of course, Martin Luther King and the Mall, in recognition, of course, now of Black History Month. So the development of this rock that we plan to carve out is getting this rock to the starting spot is incredibly important. And that occurs during the pregnancy period and the first 1,000 days. The early chiseling of that rock that sets you on your journey to defining the end sculpture that makes you occurs in the first 1,000 days. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that corrections can't be made, that the brain doesn't engender a capacity for resilience and plasticity to correct atypical trajectories, or that investments in later childhood and adolescence are not important. It just means that to maximize brain health efficiently and broadly with limited resources, that we need to optimize that rock and begin the carving out of that foundation on the right path very, very early on. Nutrition, quality care, maximal experiences and exposure to sounds and books and languages, reduction of stressors and neglect and abuse, et cetera. It's all in those early, early periods of development is extremely important to get the brain on the right path. So we here at MIDB, we're very high advocates of a lot of the work that's happening in this committee. We wholeheartedly are supporting supporting investments in our youth and infancy, and that it's extremely important ever. I'll stop there and thank you all again for having me and let me open up this session. I appreciate all the work that you all are doing here. Thank you.
Dr. Fair, thank you so much for kicking us off here and for your expertise and for hosting us. Members, I think Chair Noor and I were planning on, if there are small clarifying questions, then ask that. But otherwise, the hope is we'll get through a number of testifiers and then we're hoping to have a significant amount of time for discussion and questions. And so unless anybody has something that they're desperately needing to ask about, I'm thinking that Dr. Fair, if it's okay, we'll move on to the next testifier and then see what questions folks have overall. Thank you so much.
That sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier then is Glenn Gunderson, the president of the YMCA of the North. I'm so glad to have you with us. And so please introduce yourself and then share your thoughts.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thanks all of you for being here. And for those of you on the screen, appreciate the opportunity. Yes, Glenn Gunderson, I serve as president and CEO of YMCA of the North. Some of you are affiliated with the Y in some way through camps or through our early learning and childcare, through our health and well-being centers. So we're really grateful to be here, but I'm wearing two caps. I'm wearing a cap relative to my role with Itasca's first 1,000 days task force and a role as a large, high-quality childcare operator, if you will. So hopefully I can share some perspective on both fronts. But again, appreciate the opportunity. So representing Itasca's project, First 1,000 Days Task Force, the Itasca Project is an employer-led alliance. I'm sure many of you have been engaged or touched the Itasca Project in some ways. 70-plus private sector CEOs, public and nonprofit sector leaders based in the Twin Cities. It takes a fact-based approach to identify near-term actions our participants can take on really big sea-changing issues in our community, in our region, and in our state. Over the past decades, our region and our state has enjoyed steady growth and a high quality of life. Certainly, these last 2 years have been a pretty big upset to that apple cart, but not everybody is coming along at the pace that we would like. So there's an equity dynamic there. And often that growth has been supported by the talent the infrastructure of talent in our broader community. Our continued growth and success requires supporting our current workforce and investing in the future, especially, as you heard from Dr. Fair, in the health of our children, the future of our children. Over 100,000 families in our region have children aged 3 or younger. Itasca recognizes that employers who support employees and their children are investing in the Minneapolis-St. Paul region's future success, as well as making a smart business decision. Research, as we heard from Dr. Fair, has deepened our understanding of the development of the human brain. During the first 1,000 days of a child's life, you heard about the introduction of words, singing, playing, engagement, reducing some of the trauma-inducing experiences that have huge implications on the development of that child. How the brain develops during those formative years is largely based on external experiences that help or hinder its development. However, often families of color and low-income families face the highest barriers to healthy brain development and can translate into inequities, both economically and educationally, as well as impacting health outcomes. We estimate that nearly one-third of children born each year are at risk of unhealthy development. Itasca was compelled by that research. We asked the question, how can we act? In October 2019, we formed our first 1,000 Days Task Force to help answer that question. When we first met, we had no idea the global pandemic would upend our lives, our workforces, our families, exposing systemic challenges in our healthcare, our education, and our childcare systems, and putting enormous strain on working families with young children and creating even greater urgency. We know that family-friendly policies matter. In 2021, the task force released our report. The report is intended to help motivate employers to provide support to families with young children by sharing the story of quality childhood, early childhood development, or encouraging employers to adopt family-friendly policies, practices, and resources, supporting advocates for increased funding and better service delivery for families at greatest need. Task Force identified opportunities to better support families and young children in our region. The report identified, and we've got some of that reporting here, the report identified 4 major factors in optimal brain development that offer opportunities for intervention. Where can we get upstream and intervene? Health and wellness, knowledge and skills, community resources and support, and ensuring we address the social and economic risk factors that so many children experience day to day. Among these opportunities, we identified places where employers could play a role, either through its policies and practices or through partnerships with nonprofit organizations. And my fellow task team member on the 1,000 Days Task Force, Jonathan Weinhagen, will speak to you a bit about that in a minute. What is the current state of our child care centers? It has been a really rough patch for us to be in this business of serving young people in these age groups. Exceedingly challenging. So if you think about the challenges we've all gone through, this has not been missed in the pandemic era of challenge. Our report highlights that access to affordable, quality childcare is one of the critical ingredients for a child's healthy early development. It can also be an enabler for parents and caregivers to work and positively impact the economy. The YMCA is a large, high-quality provider of childcare in the region and throughout the state and nationally. And I wanted to share my experience a bit about what it's been like in serving in this current environment. In 2021, we served 14,600 young people at the ages 0 to 5. About 2,700 of those received financial assistance. We could have served a boatload more, but we've got a lot of kind of constraints on how we get at that. The big constraint is cost. The current cost conundrum is real. And it is prohibiting families from getting involved in certain places. Too great for many families in Minnesota, which causes some to decide to reduce their work or drop out of the workforce altogether. Not all that great from an economic perspective, And certainly there are balances in terms of that child development piece. You know, for those with means, child care can cost 10 to 15% of a family's income. That is significant. And if you're reduced certain lines from a or in a poverty realm, it is particularly or virtually impossible to engage in the system. We need more sliding fee access, more funding into CCAP, our child care assistance program, and other key supports. I would say quality really matters. And I'm not just standing up here supporting YMCA as a child care practice. There are great child care providers in this state, all of which are struggling with many of the same issues. But as Dr. Fair opened with, we follow the science. We drive at the best possible outcomes. In our case, we're seeing 99% plus kindergarten readiness. So we know high quality child care works, just carrying on even from that first 1,000 days. We're delivering on social and emotional development. And we know this is value to both parents and to the young people and or the guardians that are engaged. And I know if you went deeper into the science, you'd understand that this development is a predictor. It's a predictor for success in school, success in their own family life, remaining non-incarcerated, dropping out of school. All of those dynamics can be predicted to a degree by virtue of how well we develop that brain early. The other big piece for us is equity and affording access. Existing childcare providers are unable to meet the demand due to the staffing shortage of child care educators. This is very real for us at the Y. We have supply that we can't open to the marketplace, in effect, because we can't find enough teachers to serve. So in Rochester, in St. Cloud, in Mankato, in the Twin Cities, we have classrooms that are dark that otherwise ought to be open and vibrant with young people. And there are also geographic gaps in our community. And by the way, 75% of moms in our research are in the workforce. Just a data point, I think that's interesting. And that, you know, everything's changed relative to work and how we work through the pandemic, and probably will for all time, but an important point. And these jobs that we're asking people to take, are they're high stress and lower wage? Think about those folks in harm's way in our healthcare system right now through the pandemic. You could think about childcare workers in a similar light, maybe not quite as extreme as being in an emergency room or intubating somebody, but you're dealing with the potential to be, given pandemic through or given COVID through those that you care for. Big geographic gaps in our community. I call them childcare deserts, where we've got many square miles of places where we don't have access to good quality providers for our families. Affordability, again, the child care assistance program, funding and training and development of a staffing pipeline. We do have to figure this out at a statewide level. How do we get more of these educators into a pipeline for this profession, which we know is so important? Other challenges, I talked about the equity gaps. The child care shortage is more severe in communities that need us most. There's no doubt about it. The data would suggest that exacerbates inequalities and inequities, particularly true in communities of color and communities with lower income and rural communities. We also have kind of a funky demand quotient right now. So as you think about these return to work dynamics and some people being in a hybrid setting, some people still staying at home, there's a need for more creativity and a broader array of products or programs for families. Maybe now mom or dad is working at home 2 days a week or 2 afternoons a week and has to be in the office at certain times. That's changed everything in terms of the cost structure to deliver care. And I think that's an important consideration. And the affordability cuts both ways for us to be able to operate it effectively, as well as the affordability for families. So our ask, you know, is we need more support for families to be able to afford high quality care and an increase in capacity for our providers. And as we highlighted in the report, addressing these childcare challenges is critical both for the healthy development of our state's children, as well as to support families who want to work. And I'll pause there, Chair Pinto, in case there were any of those quick questions as you asked with Dr. Fair, and then I can turn it over to the next speaker.
I don't believe so. I think Chair Noor has taken over the next portion of the hearing.
Very good. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for the time.
And I will note for folks that the Itasca report that Mr. Gunderson referenced is both posted and also physically in the room with us as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
So the next person to testify is Jonathan Weinhagen, the president and CEO of Minneapolis Chamber of Commerce. You've had several statements about the workforce and the challenges many women are facing in the workforce. And we also know that at the state level, we dropped below, the number, which was almost close to 70% workforce participation to 67%, 2.8% drop. And most of that is because of one of the reasons we're talking about early care and childcare. Jonathan Weinhagen, welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
And good evening, Chair Pinto, Representative Noor, all of you on the committee. Thank you for having us, as well as those on the screen. Jonathan Weinhagen, President and CEO of the Minneapolis Regional Chamber. We represent 2,300 businesses across the Minneapolis-St. Paul region, ranging from Fortune 500s all the way down to single owner operators and everything in between. I'm going to one up Mr. Gunderson and say I'm coming here with four caps, not only as my cap as the CEO of the chamber. I am also a member of the First 1,000 Days Task Force, the father of four children, so near and dear to my heart, and serve in my free time as the board chair of the 10th largest school board in the state of Minnesota, the Munsell Public Schools, serving 12,000 students across seven cities in the Northern Metro. So when I talk about this being personal, it is not just about my kids, but about the kids we serve and about the kids across our state. My youngest child was 3,190 days old the day that I learned that the first 1,000 days was a thing. And I say that a little tongue-in-cheek. And it's something that I hope that we carry across our state and across our stakeholders as we think about the importance of this moment in time, this opportunity we have to drive impact for youth, to set the stage for their future. It's without a doubt that there are an exceeding number of stakeholders, arguably everyone, who values and supports families and young children, and the business community, which I represent, is certainly a part of that. Supports for healthy brain development is needed not just for children, but for families as we think about the future of our workforce and the future of our workers. We are fortunate as a region and state to boast some of the highest workforce participation amongst mothers and women, 75% in our region. And that's not by accident, but it's something that we need to continue to propel. A lack of support for children creates a barrier for parents who want to work. And I can't have a conversation with a business, large or small, today without hearing about the workforce shortage, the challenges that we're facing, in the midst of a pandemic, as we look towards an economic recovery. There's an opportunity for growth. A national survey found that 75% of mothers and 50% of fathers say they passed up work opportunities or switched jobs or stopped working in order to care for their kids. And as a father, I get it. I would do it myself. I'm fortunate to have a spouse who is doing exactly that. She is passing up work opportunities to stay home with our children, to care for them in the formative stages of their life. I talked earlier this week to a board member who leads a construction company, who talked about the trade-offs that construction workers are making with regards to one parent staying home and one person going to work. These are very real things, and it's challenging our workforce. You heard from Glenn about Itasca and the work that we're doing. I'm proud to be a partner in this employer-led effort to foster a family-friendly work environment. He talked about this priority of encouraging employers to adopt family-friendly practices. And in fact, I think he coined the fact that family-friendly policies matter, and they do. And I think it's something that we're increasingly going to hear and something we're going to challenge our legislature and our businesses to drive forward as we move into the future. We know that research has found that employers who implement these types of practices see increased employee satisfaction, productivity, and retention. We know that it also drives decreased absenteeism and healthcare costs, right?
So the data is there. All of these things come together as a solutions-based approach. There are ways for employees of all sizes and industries to support their employees, and that's something that we bring to this work. You know, many of our Fortune 500s, they employ thousands of people across multiple cities and states. They've got a lot of things in place, but just as important, the employer that employs 1, 2, 3, 10, 20 people to think about how can they lean into these opportunities around the first 1,000 days. And one of the key next steps that we're thinking about, you know, obviously there's an ask, and we're going to ask you for that, but we're also showing up with some solutions and employer-led solutions. One of those is a toolkit that we are piloting with employers, large and small, that brings policies, practices, resources to employers of all sizes to help them and their children overcome health and wellness challenges and support new parents. You know, we feel a shared responsibility. This isn't one size fits all. It's all hands on deck when we think about the approach. This toolkit includes parent education resources for employees, a list of family-friendly policies, right? So like you have copy and paste policies that employers can use in their businesses today, and case studies highlighting local companies who are successfully implementing these and the impact it's having, right? Like, again, as I talk to companies about their attraction and retention, here's a made-to-order resource that these folks can use to think about incentivizing individuals to be a part of their company. When we think about how, you know, the current state of the childcare crisis is impacting businesses, I'd be remiss not to almost just, you know, wholeheartedly defer to Glenn. He's on the ground floor. There is no greater institution than the YMCA in every corner of our region and our state who is supporting families and children every single day. And you heard him talk about the challenges. And we think about this across the childcare spectrum. You know, the YMCA is a nonprofit, it's a civic ecosystem, and it's a business. And it's a business that is experiencing workforce shortages and the challenges of attracting, retaining, and supporting talent in the very same way that a home childcare institution is facing. And that's very real. So that's something that we have to think about as we think about the future of childcare. A study by the U.S. Chamber Foundation found that employers were negatively impacted up to $11 billion a year across Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Missouri, and Texas due to absences and employer turnover. Think about that. That's five states, 10% of our states, $11 billion of economic impact in our economy. And that's exclusive of Minnesota, I would tell you, from the conversations I'm having. The very same thing is happening right here in our state. Between 28 and 40% of respondents reported that they or someone in their household has left a job, not taken a job, or changed a job because of problems with childcare in the last 12 months. So when we talk about, like, when I talk about this and you can feel the energy, it's visceral. We're hearing this. It's having an impact on our GDP growth. It's having an impact on our ability to grow companies. And I think Glenn did a nice job of talking about equity. When we talk about equity, job creation, business growth, the fastest growth segment in our state is immigrants and people of color, starting companies and growing companies. And they're impeded by their inability to have access to something as basic as childcare. I've talked about, you know, childcare organizations as businesses. They are. I think it's an important thing to underscore and highlight. You know, every single one of our childcare agencies and entities, including the Y, is employing people, is creating opportunity, is creating upward mobility, is infusing our economy. So when I think about the future, there's a lot of levers to pull. And I've worked with a lot of you, and you know that I'm not a one-size-fits-all kind of approach. I think there's a lot of levers, and we need to push them all in a similar direction. In an employer survey we conducted as part of the first 1,000 days, we asked benefit directors about the motivation to support families with young children. The key reasons driving their efforts were that it improves employee well-being and performance. Think about that. Something as simple as improving their well-being, and performance. There's a business case for this. We've proven it with the first 1,000 days. According to a recent Minneapolis Federal Reserve of Minneapolis report, the labor force participation amongst mothers with young children dropped 11.1%. Dropped 11.1%. Unprecedentedly low unemployment, unprecedentedly high need for families to have resource. And we've seen labor force participation amongst mothers drop 11.1 percentage points. These are the things that I hope carry you as you think about your work, as we think about the work that we're all going to do moving forward. I'm grateful for your leadership, grateful for your appreciation, willingness to understand the work of the first 1,000 days. Just grateful as a father and a community leader to bring this work forward. I look forward to our continued partnership. And I'm certain there's somebody who's more eloquent than me that's gonna like wrap this thing up moving forward. And I'm not sure who that is, but it's someone.
It's you.
Is it me? Oh boy, we're in trouble. And I will also stand for nuanced questions like Glenn. I like that qualification.
I don't see any questions. I know there'll be more questions during the end. So I wanted to appreciate you, those four young kids, school age, and as we go through the same challenges. So thank you so much. And I can feel it, the passion that you have because you see it every day and the sacrifices people are making, whether it's the spouse or the other person making the sacrifice, that's real. It's a lot of challenges. So thank you so much for the presentation.
Thank you.
So the next person who we have to testify is Heidi Hagel-Gray, who is the Chief Program Officer, First Children's Finance. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good evening, Chair Knorr, Chair Pinto, and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you tonight. My name is Heidi Hagel-Braid. I'm the Chief Program Officer at First Children's Finance. We are a national nonprofit organization that's headquartered here in Minnesota. And we were founded in 1991. And since that time, have been committed to the business needs of childcare over three decades. Our organization focuses on growing the supply and financial sustainability of childcare businesses, making sure that low and moderate income children have access to excellent childcare. We have sort of three different intersecting parts of our work. We work directly with childcare entrepreneurs to start, to launch, to grow, and to improve their childcare businesses. We also have a lending arm. We are a community development financial institution, CDFI. And so we provide capital to those who are potentially don't have access to them to start those businesses. The second part of our work is engaging directly with communities to build the supply of childcare that they need, that is custom and specific to their community and what parents and families are looking for. And then finally, we work with systems. We live and work in Minnesota, but at any given time, First Children's Finance is working with about 20 different states. We're currently working with two Native nations, and we're working with state, federal, and tribal systems about growing the supply of childcare, thinking about how to craft effective policy, funding mechanisms, and systems that address the business and finance need of childcare businesses. So I was asked to talk a little bit about why childcare is expensive tonight. And so in 10 minutes or less, I'm going to tell you all about that. So the business model of childcare in particular is tricky. And so I'm going to try to give you some insight and would welcome any questions that you have. I'll start by first saying that fundamentally, the childcare business model is flawed. It doesn't work in a capital market like other businesses do. The rules of supply and demand do not really apply to childcare businesses. They have a finite number of children that they can serve. And we're talking about quality measures and health and safety things that are really important. But you can't just have a fire sale on childcare. You can't just add, you know, another wing and fill it with children who are waiting. It is a labor intensive business. And that means that the personnel compensation costs are what drive the inefficiency of the business model. Let me be really clear that from the outset, we're not talking about substandard care or ways to put more kids in rooms with fewer adults. That's not at all what's important. But what I am saying is that quality is important and quality costs money. Providing excellent childcare is expensive. In order to balance the factors of cost, affordability, and quality, childcare has really subsidized the cost through compensation. It is a low-wage industry, and this is why it happens. It's true both in family childcare and childcare centers. In order to balance the books, if you will, childcare has been unable to keep pace with compensation trends. When we look at a childcare center, about 60 to 70% of their line items of expenses are directly related to personnel and compensation. So that's not a lot to work with when you add on then facility costs. They are fixed and they are at most times unlivable wages. They are not keeping pace with trends. The cost of care is largely driven by the cost of paying early educators. And it is why the childcare industry has struggled to rebound during the pandemic. Although there is high demand for care, even though that demand has changed and there's flexibility around how people are working currently, there even are parents who have the means and who are willing to pay for childcare. Early childhood jobs have not returned. I think last week I saw the Bureau of Labor Statistics cited like only 81% of those jobs had returned. The second biggest cost factor for childcare businesses, again, childcare centers and family childcare, are facility costs, which are largely fixed. Those are not things that you can renegotiate, right? That's a mortgage, that's a rent agreement. And so although for childcare centers, that might only be 20% of their expenses, when you add 60 to 70% of personnel, there's not a lot of room to pay for everything else that needs to happen in that childcare operation. And conversely, for family childcare, their home or their mortgage or the portion of the rent that they are allocating because of their business is significant, makes up about 31% of their expenses overall. So the cost of providing care is high, and it's high everywhere. Minnesota is no exception. What makes childcare different is this, is that childcare entrepreneurs, many of whom are women, and many of whom are women of color, provide a public good to the region, to the state, and to our overall national economy with limited public support. Investments in childcare subsidy are important, but overall inside of the United States, childcare subsidy only serves about 6% of eligible children. As my work takes me across the country, I have the ability to see other states struggle with similar problems. And as you learn tonight and you think about solutions, think about a suite of strategies that include the private sector, that include public investment, and a variety of different strategies to meet the needs. I would encourage you to view these investments as childcare investments in business growth, both for childcare businesses, but for all employers, small, medium, and large across the country, across Minnesota, or as investments in community vitality, because childcare is the workforce behind everyone else's workforce. And think about it as an investment in economic recovery. What I want to discourage you from is thinking that affordability is a childcare business problem to be solved. It has been solved traditionally and historically by providing low wages to its workers. That's how we got here, and we can't ask them to lower their prices. I will tell you that there are states who are asking for that, and it's not going well. So think about those investments as ways to recover the economy, to bring more people to work, and to make childcare more affordable through a way that allows childcare businesses to balance those three factors: quality, affordability, and access. We have asked the early care workforce, including those business owners, to prop up our economy for far too long without adequate public investment. I'm here to answer any of your questions that you might have about childcare business operations or the business model. Again, thank you for the opportunity to share the information with you. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hagel-Braid, for that. I don't know if anyone has got a quick question. Otherwise, the testifiers are with us. We have got two more testifiers. I'll now transfer to Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Ms. Hagel-Braid, thank you so much for sharing your expertise. Thank you. For our last testifiers, I hate to do this to you, but you're both pros, so that you can handle them. And ask you if you can each, we'll have Mr. Sertich come on up, and just if you could each take just about 5 minutes so we can make sure we have time, 5 minutes apiece. So calling up Tony Sertich, President and CEO of the Northland Foundation, and important to note in a House setting, a former House Majority Leader, and just so good to have you back in contact with us in the House. And so please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, committee members in the room and virtually as well. My name is Tony Sertich, and I'm the president of the Northland Foundation. We serve 7 counties and 5 Native nations in northeastern Minnesota. We're one of 6 Minnesota Initiative foundations who are regional philanthropic organizations that serve 80 of the 87 counties in greater Minnesota. We're independent of each other, but we, each of us, each 6 of the Initiative foundations focus on our earliest learners and economic development. And so I feel very comfortable being in front of both of these committees today. Honored to speak before you today in 5 short minutes to talk a bit about a greater Minnesota perspective to this crisis. First and foremost, I want to thank the legislature for your past support of a lot of the work that we've been in partnership with at the Initiative Foundations, and I'll just list a couple of them to provide some context. We are grateful for the funding for childcare expansion through DEED. We are getting capital on the ground to help grow family and center facilities all across greater Minnesota. We were awarded, Northland Foundation, one of the largest grants this last go-around, about $240,000. Yet when we informally asked our communities the need, they came back with $4 million of capital need. And so grateful for the largest grant, but much more need out there in greater Minnesota. And on the other side, the Northland Foundation serves as the regional administrator of early learning scholarships. And so we're right at the front lines dealing with families and providers, especially of low-income families of color and others who are struggling to make ends meet and are needing those scholarships to afford child care in our region. And as soon as we get those dollars, we get them out the door, about $2 million a year, and we have waiting lists in that realm. We've seen some successes over the past few years when we talk about that access to capital. And I want to talk and lean a little bit more on family providers coming from greater Minnesota. Northland Foundation, as I said, serves 7 counties in northeastern Minnesota. What you need to know about how they drew counties back when they drew the counties, it was about a horse being able to get to the county seat in a day's time. But I also think folks got tired of drawing counties when they got north. So when I say 7 counties, they just drew bigger counties when they got up there because they got tired. The 7 counties in northeastern Minnesota is roughly a quarter of the geographic region of our state and roughly the size of West Virginia. And so centers don't work in a lot of our small rural communities. We rely on family providers. But as Heidi said, the system is broke, and we've seen a significant decrease in the number of family providers in this state. But we've seen some successes. And so when we've been able to partner and provide capital to communities, I think of North Holme, Minnesota, up in Represent Eklund's district in Kuching County, population 219 people, helped create 10 slots. That helps solve 25% of their shortage in North Holme by creating 10 slots. Can't put a center there, but that's significant. Helped in Silver Bay in Lake County up on the North Shore, 72 slots. That was a center in partnership with their school and some businesses. That reduced their demand by 77%. So there are successes that are happening when we're able to infuse public dollars and capital to help with this crisis. I'm here, though, to say that we lead the state in northeastern Minnesota in a factor that we don't want to be the leader in the state in. We have a 46% shortage in childcare slots. And I hate that we talk about it that way, because a slot is just like a number, and that's a percentage. And it's 4,500 some slots. But really what that means is there's 4,500 kids who don't have childcare in northeastern Minnesota today, tomorrow, and into the future. And those are families, and those are potential employees and employers. And that's a drag on our economy, but also an opportunity for growth. I'm going to give you a couple quick perspectives. First, a family perspective. Nearly 80% of Minnesota families, all parents are employed in the household. We've heard statistics about women and stuff, but it's 80% all parents are employed. And families are having trouble finding this access. And I'll just give you some examples that we've seen in northeastern Minnesota. One of them is a person who lives in Ely, Minnesota. Many of you know where Ely is, and has to work in Virginia. To give you a little perspective, they have to drive from Ely. And I'm not going to use hours because some of you in the metro might think about traffic. There is no traffic between Ely and their job. They're going 65 and sometimes more the whole way. So they have to drive from Ely to Hibbing. That's 71 miles. That's past Virginia to get to their childcare facility. Then they have to double back to Virginia another 25 miles to go to their job. And then go back to Hibbing and then go back to Ely every single day, every single week, because that's where they can find childcare. So when we talk about center-based or family-based or a broken system, the density, the lack of density in Greater Minnesota brings unique challenges to solving this crisis. And one last thing on a family perspective, a third of households in northeastern Minnesota only make $35,000 a year. So when you, once again, talk about percentages of income going to childcare, that's a significant percentage of an income when you put on top of it food and housing and then what is left. We work a lot with providers. We provide no-cost training, help with parent-aware rating systems that I know many on the Early Childhood Committee know about. I'm just going to talk briefly about our loss of family providers. In the last 10 years in our region, we have lost over 170 family providers. Many of them have aged out. They started doing this as a job when their kids were young, stuck with it, and now are retiring. And so almost half of that loss has happened in the past 4 years. And there are not a lot of women or men, but as Heidi has said and others, this is primarily women-owned businesses who are coming in behind because, gratefully, they have better opportunities to start businesses and do that. I drive by a sign every day when I leave my house. And it is an advertisement for a fast food place in town who's looking for employees. And I drive by the sign every day, and it motivates me around this issue. It says that we're willing to hire, and we're willing to hire adults at $17 an hour. And we know the average pay for our early childhood educators is significantly less than that $17 an hour that that fast food restaurant is providing in pay. I'll talk quickly about a provider in Proctor, Minnesota, and that's population 3,000 people. Shelly is a former pre-K teacher herself. She started a facility in 2013, was able to expand to a second facility, but with the pandemic had to close down and close down to only being able to offer infant slots. And the only reason she stayed open wasn't because she could afford to, it's because she's in the small town and knew it was absolutely necessary. And that's what happens in small towns when you have to interact with folks and you go to the same church and the same softball games and the same grocery stores. She said, the only reason we're still open is because my husband has a good job. And as Heidi said, we are pushing this pressure down to people by the grace of the goodness in their hearts to provide this needed opportunity for our kids to a lot of women and families who out of the goodness of their heart are staying open. Last thing I'll say when I wrap up here is, from a business perspective, Northam Foundation works with a lot of small businesses, entrepreneurs, and economic developers in our region. I cannot go to a local EDA on the Iron Range, a Chamber of Commerce, or an economic development organization where the top two issues about attracting good paying jobs to our region, the first two issues they want to talk about is not about site locations or anything else, housing and childcare, is on the front of mind of every economic development professional that I interact with in that sector of my job. And I'll leave you with this. I, too, come to you today as somebody in philanthropy, as an employer, and as a father. And those first 1,000 days, They go really fast for those of you that have kiddos in your lives, right? And you can only do it once, and you can't push pause. And I've been in your chairs as an elected official. And so I'm going to really have two quick asks for you here. I know this is an incredibly short session. And where I see childcare, it's a bucket with a bunch of holes in it. And we're trying to fill up a bucket with a bunch of holes in it. And so whatever you can do to help maintain as much water in that bucket this year for those kids that are in those first 1,000 days of their life is absolutely necessary. But the system is fundamentally broken. And for some of my friends who say regulations, we have to solve that, yes. But if you eliminated every regulation on the books in early childhood, I don't think that would help grow the 4,500 slots that we're short in Northeastern Minnesota. But also to my friends who just say put more money into a bucket that's broken, we're not gonna get there either, because the North homes and some of these small rural communities are still not gonna be able to pay the wages necessary and compete with those fast food restaurants. So two quick things. I think public funding for these educators should be more commensurate with our teachers than fast food workers. And I would see us tying more our funding towards our educators. And then secondly, a policy that incentivizes families and businesses to allow more parents or primary care adults to be with their children in those first 1,000 days. People far smarter than me, like Dr. Fair, have talked about the compelling data. If we can incentivize more families who want to stay with their kids those first 1,000 days, it's going to help with business retention, help with that kiddos' growth, and help with the stress of our families. Thank you, Mr. Chairs, and I'll be over there willing to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thanks for sharing your expertise, making the drive down, and we'll be calling on you. And Ms. Wallstein, if you can come on up as our final speaker. And members, we kind of have two reports that we're hearing about today. One is the Itasca Project First 1,000 Days White Paper. We've heard some discussion about that, but that set of employers. There very recently was a report issued by the Early Care and Education Crisis Work Group. And we've got Amy Wallstein with the Minnesota Business Partnership to talk about that, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Amy Wallstein. I'm the Education Policy and Workforce Development Director for the Minnesota Business Partnership. We're an organization that represents the CEOs and senior leaders of some of Minnesota's largest employers, many of whom are deeply involved in childcare and early education initiatives through the Itasca Project, First 1,000 Days, Little Moments Count, and more. For several years, our organization has participated in the Early Care and Education Crisis Work Group, along with a variety of other business and children's advocacy groups. We've been working to formulate solutions to several childcare-related crises facing Minnesota. The initial crises we identified were supply. Minnesota is currently experiencing a severe shortage of quality childcare and early education programs. More than 31,000 low-income children still can't access the quality early learning programs they need to succeed. Minnesota also faces some of the nation's worst education achievement and opportunity gaps, which only deepened during the pandemic. Some of these disparities stem in part from lack of access to early childcare and early education. In a newer crisis, but a really significant one, Minnesota has a critical labor shortage that threatens our economy now and into the future. The theme that runs through these crises is a system in need of reform. The lack of access to affordable quality childcare and early education is creating compounding issues for our children, families, communities, and our economy. Affordable access to early care and education programs is necessary to ensure all families can confidently participate in the workforce while children are developing skills necessary to prepare them for future success. The working group has released several reports or a report and several follow-up pieces, including the one that Chair Pinto just mentioned. Everything's available online. And the report that we recently released is more detailed than I have time to outline today, but let me quickly summarize some of our recommendations. First and foremost, we recommend investing in early learning scholarships for the 31,000 low-income Minnesota children under the age of 5 who can't access quality early childcare and education programs. These are the children whose families can least afford childcare and the children who are most likely to fall into achievement and opportunity gaps that pose a threat to their future. Beyond closing gaps, scholarships also create new consumer demand to incentivize childcare businesses to stay open and expand. Members of the business partnership understand that when consumer demand is stimulated, the supply of product will grow. The legislature should tap into these reliable market forces. Scholarships are the best available tool for solving these 31,000 children. They start early before gaps arise. They're targeted the most advantaged children. They're flexible and portable to fit the unique needs of families, and they're centered on quality. Second, a lot of funding has been put into the Minnesota's Child Care Assistance Program, which also helps low-income children. And CCAP reimbursement rates have increased significantly last year. Investing in this program helps families. As we add additional dollars to this program, the Crisis Working Group recommends that the legislature make some reforms to CCAP programs to ensure that supports are linked to quality via the parent aware ratings. So children in CCAP funded programs are benefiting from the use of kindergarten readiness best practices, and that children receive continuous access to quality care from birth to kindergarten entry. The working group made a number of other recommendations that are also very important. For instance, we recommend better data collection and analysis, as the Minnesota legislative auditor recommended, to help make state investments more efficient, affordable, and accountable. Efficient, effective, and accountable. This session, the working group is focused on ensuring we have a uniform kindergarten entry assessment as a next step in this direction. Finally, we endorse the consolidating state programs into a single streamlined state agency, a new Department of Early Learning. While this is far from a panacea, we believe this consolidation makes more sense than continuing to administer programs in an unfocused way through Department of Education, Department of Health and Human Services. In conclusion, the working group report provides a lot of detail on these recommendations, and I encourage you to review the report. Our working group worked very hard on them, and we hope that you found them useful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wolstein. Turning things back to Chair Neuer for the Q&A section. Thanks so much for sharing your information.
Thank you so much, members. This is an opportunity. Representative Cagle, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is for Ms. Hengelbrain or for Representative Uters. Tony, I was a page when you were majority leader. So I was just kind of curious, what are some of the barriers to attracting employment, but then also retaining employees? When I was dropping my Carol off this morning, I just kind of was having an informal conversation about the benefits they get at daycare. And so it doesn't sound like there's many fringe benefits offered by these child care centers. So I was kind of curious about that. I have a couple more after that too, sir.
Sure, I'll start. Feel free to jump in. The compensation, of course, is low, but often the childcare businesses really struggle to be able to provide ancillary benefits like health or retirement or anything else. And for many people who start these businesses, they are their own entrepreneurs, right? So in the family childcare situation, they have to have the business knowledge to be able to sort of structure their businesses to be able to pay themselves first. But the profitability of the businesses is quite low. And so there is always the struggle to be able to maintain competitive wages. It just is really difficult. And there are very little benefits. I think sometimes large nonprofits like Glenn's Live Operations, probably because they're doing more than childcare, have the ability to invest in those fringe benefits. But for small childcare centers and for family childcare providers who may employ like a helper, there just is no room in the budget.
Because of cases.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there some ways that, you know, what are some ways that you think the state can help? I'm on the jobs or the workforce development committee, so I'm really thinking about this as kind of the workforce side of it. So what are some ways that the state can maybe help incentivize workers towards these positions or help the child care centers, you know, maintain their employees as well? You know, we're lucky to go to a child care center where a lot of the women working there have been there for a number of years. And so that's nice, but not a lot of, you know, there's also some turnover too. So I'm just kind of curious about, you know, what are some ways that the state can help incentivize some of that workforce shortage issues?
Ms. Hagel, please.
So there's a number of ways, and I think a lot of states are taking advantage of the opportunity to think differently. So one of the things that's happening currently in Minnesota is the child care stabilization grants have a requirement that 70% of the funds, I believe, have to be dedicated toward compensation. So if you're thinking about public investment, the best way to make movement is to, I call it double knotting, right? Like tie that public investment to changes in compensation. Because these small businesses are struggling. They have a lot of priorities. You know, they may not think about compensation as the first thing to address. They might have deferred facility maintenance, lots of things that are apparent. And so tying public investment to compensation is a really good strategy.
Representative Cagle.
One last one, and this is for Mr. Sertich, the child care partnership. So I was just kind of curious, you mentioned Silver Bay. Mm-hmm. My grandma lives on Otter Drive, mm-hmm. right across from Zups. So I think about Silver Bay and I think about the economic hub that's there, which is reserve mining or whatever it's called now. And so, you know, that makes sense to have, you know, kind of some partnership with either reserve or the, you know, so are you guys kind of looking at those employment hubs in the area and trying to partner with those places where the workers are going to be coming and, you know, making sure that they have childcare there for them?
Mr. Sutt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, certainly in those conversations across the board with employers, because employers are recognizing that they need some skin in the game in one way, shape, or form. The partnership that happened up in Silver Bay was actually with the school district. And then finding an empty building that the community was able to basically give to the provider to lower those costs, because that's the other cost driver that was talked about before, is that if you're paying rent or paying a mortgage, that's directly cutting into your profitability as an organization. So in many small rural communities, getting that off of the books for the business helps significantly so that they can focus more on the wages of employees for profitability. And so the school district, the local community, able to find a building and help with some of the renovation costs were the partnerships that worked in Silver Bay.
One of the empty elementary buildings.
Sorry,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. I know you talked about the investment that we made, you know, historic investment. Thank you to Representative Olson. We were giving only $750,000 for the first time historic investment of $8 million that we've made through the deed grants, and there's more left. That was the first round. We're expecting more in the second round. Representative Wesley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, I think I'd like to hear from Dr. Fair on this maybe a little bit about, you sort of said the distance between like research and then actually doing something with that research. My first year in grad school in 2010, I saw a presentation for Art Rolnick about the return on investment of early childhood. And here we are still not investing enough. Can you talk a little bit about that gap between like research, we know what the research says, and like where the barriers are to getting that research from research to public conversation to public policy? If you could maybe offer some thoughts on that.
Mr. Fair.
Yeah, I mean, and it's actually one of the reasons why I'm here, you know, is that there, you know, scientists are, I talk about this a lot, we're not very good communicators. We have difficulty articulating the importance of certain things in a way that can be grasped by, you know, folks that are not scientists.
And so, you know, one of the things that we've been thinking through really heavily here is how to partner with folks who are good communicators. And that would be, you know, our oftentimes policymakers, our, you know, politicians tend to be pretty good communicators, actually, oftentimes, right? Or, you know, folks who we have new science writers and others that are coming here to help us articulate the importance of these things. I just think that part of the dynamic is that they're just not a natural, organic, and, you know, this has historically changed. Think about how, you know, the number of MDs and scientists used to also be policymakers. That has just completely diminished over time. So now it's just separation. And I think that's part of, you know, and so we're trying to, you know, what we're trying to do here at MIDB is reconnect those links so we can make better progress a lot more efficiently. At the same time, hopefully we can, you know, give a little boost to scientists like me so we can make our points more clearly and why this stuff is so important. President Breslin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to flip the question to Mr. Weinhagen now. Same question to you, but what do you see as sort of the science from the science of the business community? What do you see as barriers there? Because I think that's another piece of sort of now the business community seems to be a lot more vocal about childcare and early education and things now, at least locally. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what those barriers have been between the science to the business community.
Mr. Wenheim.
I appreciate the question, Mr. Chair. I would like to highlight that Mr. Fair did not suggest the business community was the articulate. so noted, my friend. Totally fine. Any of you and I will not take offense to that. I think it's a little complicated. You know, what we're hearing is a very real and visceral impact. So when we think about return on investment and how businesses are experiencing the child care challenge. I think we all believe in the science. As you look at the data in the first 1,000 days, if you look at the report that Amy shared, like all of that is very real. We are, to some extent, kind of on the ground floor for us. You know, so many folks in the childcare realm and the youth realm have been talking about this for decades. To some extent, and I'll just acknowledge it, we're catching up. And in part because we are experiencing it every single day, and it's having a notable and marked impact on the ability for companies to attract talent, to retain talent, and to grow. So that's kind of where the business community is at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to sort of, I think that it's evident to me, I mean, even before seeing the stuff in the Itasca project, but that we know that, you know, these quality early childhood and childcare experiences are good for, you know, public safety, they're good for job growth, all these things. And it continues to be frustrating to me that we don't push our resources into those, knowing that the long-term outcomes are really good for like all of these things that we all say we care a lot about. So I just want to highlight that. And I think one of the issues is the science, is translating the science to get it out to who needs to hear it, but then also like acknowledging the science and saying like we should actually listen to what is coming out of this and invest in housing and childcare and early education and all these things. So just want to make that last point, and I'll leave it up to the next person.
Thank you. Representative Cortizo, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I so appreciate this series of hearings that we've been able to put together over the last couple of years. And so kudos to both Chair Pinto and Chair Noor. I'm really grateful to be able to serve on both of these committees. I wanted to just tie a couple of things, a couple of comments that were mentioned through the testifiers together in my head. It's not so much of a question, but just more of just putting a couple of things together and with something, with a meme that I saw recently, actually. And hello, Mr. Representative Juergens' little one that he's showing on the screen there.
Someone else on the show.
If you guys can't,
talking about them.
I absolutely, and I could turn on my camera and bring in my little one. That's why I stay home tonight, too. He's in the first 550 days of his life. So, but yes, so I really appreciated Ms. Hagelbraid's comment about that childcare, the workforce of childcare is everybody else's workforce. And I think that that's just such a really important way to tune in to how this impacts not only families across the state of Minnesota, but our businesses across the state. So I'm really grateful for the participation and partnership of our business leaders. The meme that I saw, I'm thinking of, and it's another low-income industry, unfortunately, so for the PCAs, but it was something along the lines of somebody had seen a posting, not unlike the one that Mr. Sertich had mentioned, about a fast food restaurant being able to pay $17 or $18 an hour, really just trying to bring in any workers. And the comment was, if people are actually getting paid $18 an hour to flip burgers, then our PCA should be getting that or more to flip grandma. And yes, of course, that's a really not a very nice way to say that. I'm saying those are not my words. That was what the meme said. But it's the same impact, right? And I just really want to call out the fact that oftentimes in these discussions, particularly maybe in the Workforce and Business Development Committee, we talk as though, or folks will talk as though, these workers are like that somebody working at a fast food restaurant is earning $18 an hour, that it's taking away from a child care worker who's only making $11 an hour, or from a PCA who's only making, you know, $12.12 an hour, whatever it is. And so I think that we really have to just pay attention that these things are not mutually exclusive. And in fact, like Ms. Hagelbraid mentioned earlier, when we create a stronger child care workforce, the workforce strengthens itself throughout the entire economy. So I really thought that was impactful, and kind of just tying it into something that I had, you know, that was on my mind recently. But I just really appreciate this conversation and the partnership between all the organizations here tonight, and look forward to continuing it.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to our chairs for doing this hearing. I think this was really good. In my first in-person hearing, and from our first term members, this was their very first in-person hearing. So it's exciting to be in the same room, and maybe because of that, it feels like there's just more synergy in the moment to meet the moment, and to have such phenomenal chairs at that. The thing I was really struck by, because I sit on the workforce committee, I don't often get to hear the brain development, the science, the early that part of this conversation. We talk more about the workforce shortage, about things like capital, things like that. And so to be in this conversation, I was really struck by the idea of kind of the yes and how we're talking about needing everything. But not only do we need to do everything we're talking about with the childcare, but I think it was kind of to Mr. Weinhagen's point that investing in ourselves, we all said it, we all wear multiple hats. We are caregivers, we are workers in all of these sectors, and we need to do something to acknowledge that. And I think the science today really, you know, I was looking at this chart, it's not even the first 1,000 days, it's that first year is so important. And we are the best caregivers in those early years. And so, you know, we have a set of things that can address that are at the legislature this year, but we need that, we need to think about the childcare workforce and investing, as we just heard. We need to do the capital, but we need to think of ourselves as those caregivers, and all of our constituents are the best people to be with those kids during that first year. And, you know, I commend you in saying kind of that's a direction you're willing to move as a business community to think about as you put in those family-friendly policies. And I think that's great. And I think we need to move in that direction and do all of the other stuff we typically think about as childcare. So I just was really moved by kind of all of that coming together in this moment tonight.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Parr.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And I again, you know, appreciate all the presentations tonight, because the perspectives that you bring is so valuable to us, and that the way you articulate it is so strong. And for us in early childhood, certainly strong reminders of what we've heard in the past and what we're focusing on. And then again, to be reminded of how important this is to workforce. I wanted to go back again and bring together some of the things we've talked about, which is from Ms. Hagelbraid, you talked about our workers are subsidizing the industry right now with their low wages to make it affordable. But then to go back to Dr. Fair, and how you talked about the importance of that first 1,000 years, or 1,000 days, the 1,000 days, but even that first year, and what you learned in research about what happens and why a child care provider, what it is, what the work is that they're doing that's so important to the child, and what we mean when we talk about quality child care. And if you could just talk a little bit about that, what is that child care provider doing, that caregiver, that is so important to brain development?
Mr. Fair.
Right, so and I think everybody here has it, you know. Even, you know, it's the first 1,000 days, but that first year, you know, when you're building the mold, essentially, of how, you know, the foundation of how the trajectory is going to go for, in essence, the rest of your life. That's that. And if families and parents and, you know, don't have folks to help assist in the context of working families and, you know, don't have to help build that mold, then it's going to be a long road, and it's going to be a lot harder to maximize the you know, the outcomes in any given child. So the importance of these early caregivers is extremely important, because that's when you're setting the stage essentially for the rest of your life right at that time.
Professor Park.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, I just wanted to note, this is more about the two-generational approach, whereby we're taking care of the young ones at the same time the parent, to make sure that there's that balance in the process. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I echo this, and as a first-term member, who this is my first in-person committee hearing, it's been a good one.
The first 1,000 days.
Feels like it. But I do, and I think just sort of building off of the last couple of comments, because I think it would be really interesting if one of our next hearings to actually hear from some early childhood providers and think a little bit more about curriculum. I will say, my father was an early childhood expert, and so I'm a lawyer. I don't really speak with any expertise, but I remember talking a lot about, you know, in those first 1,000 days, care really matters, and it's also education, right? It's play looks different. Education looks different for an infant versus a toddler versus a preschooler. But in the same way, we think about the professionalization of teachers and all of those folks providing care, I do think that it really matters. And to what you said, Mr. Sertich, is we really need to think about compensating these workers and these providers as educators. And I think we also need to think about that as a full spectrum of what does it mean to invest in that workforce as educators. And so how do we keep, and as someone on workforce, how do we keep people in those jobs, right? And I think you had said, you know, someone left for a better opportunity, or people leave once their kids are out because it just sort of doesn't make sense anymore. And so how are we, you know, there's an immediate problem we have because people are leaving as the labor market gets tighter. And there's a longer term thing, which is, how are we thinking about compensation? How are we thinking about professional development? And I'm just interested, I think both of you sort of spoke to that, but it feels like it marries the, like, we're talking about kids and their development and making sure that what they have access to is gonna set them on the right path and on the path. And we're talking about equity. And we're talking about a workforce that is traditionally women and many women of color that we aren't investing in. I'm wondering if you have thoughts about how we can sort of think about the workforce shortage issues with the 1,000 days and from that educator lens, if you have any ideas to impart or places to start that conversation.
I'll say briefly, but you're going to know more. I mean,
Mr. Sedgwick, go ahead.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Now that we know more, we got to do more, right? I mean, if we know that those first 1,000 days matter, and we know that we have higher expectations than 20 years ago when I was sitting in the chairs that you all were sitting in, and Art Rolnick was just starting to talk about this. We know more now. It's been germinating. And so we have higher expectations as society. We are demanding quality for our kiddos in different ways. We're demanding that those professionals have degrees and certificates, but we're not paying them any differently.
So it's that basic to me. I mean, sometimes it's not about the money, but sometimes it is about the money. And this is one of those times that if we are requiring, demanding as a society, and there's a good proper public investment because of the scientific research, the money should follow that.
Ms. Breaker.
Agreed, absolutely. And it's time to do, right? We've been learning for a long time. And I think it's time to innovate and experiment and learn from what other systems are trying. There's lots of great research. There's lots of great blueprints to follow, right? But if we aren't willing to take action and try, I think you're going to continue to learn, and that's good. But experimenting and finding out what works is also really important. And at the end of the day, I agree with Mr. Sertich that money is important, right? And we have to retain our workforce in the early care industry through compensation.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hegel-Bright, and for that statement. I'll be remiss if I don't call the chair for education, Chair Dabney.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It's been a powerful evening of testimony, and I want to thank all of the testifiers for being here. What strikes me is a common theme has been the sense of urgency. And I'm just wondering if any of the testifiers would like to speak specifically to maybe where their sense of urgency is coming from, or where they see that sense of urgency best focused.
Anyone who wants to take that from the business to the scientific research and all that? Mr. Sturridge, or go ahead. People are shy to take on. That's a significant approach to understanding the challenge. Go ahead.
I think my sense of urgency comes from the calls and the voicemails that our staff get in the middle of night, where entrepreneurs are figuring out how to make payroll, how to keep the doors open of the childcare businesses they've worked so hard to create. I also hear, as an employer and as a supervisor, the stress that parents are under as they are juggling work and care and the affordability of care. And that trauma that we've experienced over the 2 years, the past 2 years, and now rounding into the third, I just don't know how much longer some folks can hang on. And so there's a sense of urgency in the care sector.
Mr. Sadich, if you wanted to respond.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, my classmate, two quick things. We don't get a do-over for any kid in those first 1,000 days. So that's my first sense of urgency. The second one is, which provides me hope, is that you all
are recording in progress.
Oh, what?
You're hearing from every sector that the system's broken. We have to do more. We have to do different. I think that's giving political permission, as Heidi said, to try some things different. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. But everybody's telling you the system's broke. So it goes back to the other analogy of the definition of insanity is trying the same thing again and again and expecting different results. Mm-hmm. I believe you have permission from all sectors to invest, to try different things, because there's no do-over.
Jenna.
No, thank you for the both testifiers for those statements, because I do think it's the urgency that we also have. We not only have the permission, to Mr. Sertich's point, we have the resources.
Absolutely. Lead
thank
Hamilton.
Chair.
Thank you so much. Lead Hamilton.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Noor. And I just want to reiterate as well, I really appreciate all the testimony and all the testifiers. I was very intrigued with what former Representative Sertich said as well. All our districts are very, very different. And the district that I serve encompasses all or a portion of four different counties. And if you drive from one corner to the other, it's almost 100 miles. And the largest community is about 13,000 people. And myself and Senator Weber were invited to a meeting down there. And it was a very inclusive group of people, from educators to child care providers to business leaders to local elected officials and bankers as well. And in that group discussion, no one could come up with a proposal that would cash flow. And it did come down to building costs, and it came down to, of course, labor expenses. And so we have to be able to come up with a workable solution to address those issues, no question about it. Because as one person said, the things that I hear most down in the area in which I serve is housing and childcare. So again, I greatly appreciate this meeting, and I also appreciate everybody getting together. I wish I was there, but
we're missing.
Right, it's good to see everybody. So again, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Lynn Hamilton. And as we, reach the hour, it's already 7 p.m. I just wanted to also note something that Jonathan Wenhagen said about, getting incentives there, paid family medical leave. We've got in Minneapolis, we've got unsafe and sick time. Those are essential to get, folks to care for their little ones, and also to do the bonding for their kids when they're still young in the first 1,000 days. So we need to look at the whole picture, comprehensive picture of how do we address this need. At the same time, balance the work and everything else. So thank you so much. At least, I don't know if you wanted to quickly comment on that or just pin it, and then we can talk about it at a different time.
I think we're good.
And I just want to thank, so it did not occur to me till the middle of this hearing this point that this is our first chance to be in person for a number of us. And we really do miss you, Representative Hamilton, and the other members of the committee who weren't able to be with us in person. This is not an easy thing to do in COVID time, and so I need to thank Ms. Spreck and Mr. Reese, the committee administrators, and Mr. Dosland and Mr. Bodry, the committee legislative assistants, and to Frank Forsberg and Kristen Spargo, who helped put this together, and then certainly to Dr. Fair and to the Masonic Institute. We really appreciate being here.
I don't want to forget about the Minnesota House Info for streaming this.
That's a great point.
They do great work. And in fact, they received an award for doing a great job during this pandemic. So thank you to the House Info for the great work they're doing. So thank you all for coming.
And let me just note, there is a tour of the facility that's available right afterwards for those of us in person. And it seems like we've got a good sense of the urgency and eager to continue to work together to act. So, Mr. Chair, thank you so much for hosting us.
With that, I think we are joined for the evening. So thank you so much for joining us.